Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Hello, and welcome to Good One, a podcast about jokes. I'm your host, Jesse David Fox. Each episode, a guest comes on to play a clip of one of their jokes and then discusses how they wrote it and how it fits into what they're trying to do with their comedy. This week's guest is Nally Palamides, whose new one-person show, Nate, premiered on Netflix today. This show, man, I saw her doing it live in Brooklyn in the summer of 2019 after hearing for years how unique and hilarious and gutsy she was, and I was not ready. In Nate, Nally Palamides plays Nate Palomino, a lovable idiot trying to figure out dating and overcoming toxic masculinity in the post-Me Too era. And the show is a reflection of her unique journey through comedy. It's part sketch character, it's part devised theater, it's part clowning. And when I say clowning, it's the sort of fancy French derivative kind. I'm no big city clown expert, but it'll be useful to know a few things for this interview. Clowns aren't just the red nose, rubber chicken, birthday party kind. As Natalie likes to say, Charlie Chaplin was a clown, Lucille Ball was a clown, more recently Sacha Baron Cohen is someone who studied clowning. Clowning is a comedic performance art that necessitates a willingness to take risks and use failure as a springboard to the next moment. It's an art form that needs to be done in front of people, as clowns are supposed to be vulnerable with the audience. They must connect with the audience. They must follow what the audience gives them. And because of the mix of all those backgrounds, she has such a unique relationship with her audience. She's constantly playing with them. She's constantly pushing their buttons. She gets a lot of volunteers and makes them uncomfortable. And she's able to sit in discomfort longer than I think any comedian I've ever seen. And I could say anecdotally, as a person who was not called on, who tried very hard not to be called on, the entire time I was like trying to hide in the corner. And, you know, I loved every minute of it. What is amazing is they were able to capture that filmed. It really is a remarkable comedic achievement. This is the type of thing that I always want to see in comedy. It's just so daring and unique and pushes the boundaries of the form. In the scene we're going to play, which comes fairly early in the show, Nate takes a log he was chopping with an axe for no real reason and places it center stage and sits down. It's a moment to give the audience some insight into the character before a bunch of crazy shit happens. Namely, soon after, he wrestles a male audience member, both with their shirts off. One physical thing of note. After Nate says express yourself for the second time, he pours LaCroix seltzer on his cheeks. It will make sense soon enough, I promise. Well, not totally, but it'll make enough sense soon enough. So, here is Nally Palamides.
Ice. My ex. She just broke up with me. And I asked her everything. I asked her before I kissed her. I asked her before I ate her pussy. Damn, I miss that tuna casserole. I even asked her to, take my Gam Gam's ring. But she said no. Come on, Nate. Express yourself. Come on, Nate. Express yourself. Wow. So that's what crying feels like. I don't know if I'll ever find love again. Although, I have started noticing my art teacher, Miss Jackson. I'm taking this adult night painting class over at the local middle school. You know the one. So I guess I could use some relationship advice. Anybody here in a relationship? Who's here with their partner right now?
So I am here with Natalie Palamides. Thank you for joining me. So before I want to back up and we discuss sort of your and Nate's journey together, just for context, I want to discuss a little bit of Nate as a finished product, specifically since this is an audio medium. First, can you describe mm-hmm. what Nate looks like to the people who have not seen video or pictures of him yet?
Yes, so Nate has a big black mustache, big black eyebrows, big black sideburns, a mysterious black eye that's never explained, scruffy black hair, a buffalo plaid jacket, thick chest hair, and some army pants and big black boots.
Was that an image that you sort of had? And whenever you started getting to this part of the show, was that sort of the image you had in your head? It was like, what is this person? You had that image. Did the image almost come before other parts of the character?
Of the full costume? No. I started developing the character maybe 8 years ago now. And he didn't even have a mustache back then when I first started him. So I call that Baby Nate. And he wore more like a baseball shirt. The costume was something that I found just throughout the workshopping of the show. And his black eye wasn't there until maybe a couple workshops in. And yeah, just definitely some details, you know, came in throughout the workshopping process. I had black pants and like a black button-down T-shirt that I wore initially. He always wore some sort of bandana around his head. I forgot to mention that. Mm-hmm. He always kind of looks like a badass, a sloppy badass dude, with an exposed chest, a hairy chest. That's always been consistent. He's always been pretty hairy.
And who is Nate? Especially as the moment that we're going to talk about. Who is Nate in this moment? Who is Nate?
Nate, I would describe him simply as a douchebag with a heart of gold. Mm-hmm. And I think by the end of the show, he's still a douchebag with a heart of gold, but he grows by learning about himself and about others and about communication, I suppose, and vulnerability. And yeah, there's different ways that he grows and opens up. And I would say that's how he changes throughout the show.
So
he becomes more comfortable with vulnerability, I think, is a big thing.
Yeah. So you mentioned a little bit. So let's flash back to 8 years ago when you're still in college at, I believe you're still in college, at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Where you? I know you took a workshop. Was it at school or was this in Philadelphia?
Yeah. Well, so it was a workshopping of a play. So I was actually workshopping a piece called I Promise Myself to Live Faster with the Pig Iron Theater Company. Mm-hmm. And the piece was inspired by the work of Charles Ludlam. And he was really famous for doing classical plays in drag and still being able to move people to tears. Mm-hmm. And I took that as inspiration for my work, you know, from that point on. But also in the workshopping of that show, we were developing many, many, many drag characters. And so I was just dishing out a bunch of dudes throughout that entire workshopping process. And Nate kind of surfaced that way. And the first piece that I did with him during that workshop was him sitting in silence in a basement, very melancholic, chugging a 2-liter bottle of soda, and burping. It was kind of a silent piece, seeing this very masculine guy, really sad and vulnerable, and intermittently burping. And then I think also part of the comedy from the piece came from the task of having to finish this bottle of soda.
Mm-hmm. When does Nate show up again, and sort of, but also where had he existed sort of in your repertoire of characters or voices up to the point where you then do him again?
Well, so I would bring him back every so often in some sketches. I made a video with Baby Nate with a sketch group called Little Red Feathers. Mm-hmm. You could probably find it on YouTube. It's just called Nate. And then I brought Nate back to live theater or live comedy when I got back from Edinburgh in 2017. Mm-hmm. At the Lyric Hyperion, which is one of the clown hubs in Los Angeles, we throw up these shows called The Incubator. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's kind of a week-long boot camp of shows where on the first night, you put up something brand new, and then you do that show every single night, and your piece develops throughout the week, and everybody who's in this variety show watches each other's bits and helps their friends develop their pieces. And so the director of that show, Dr. Brown, who also directed Nate and my other solo show, he directs the incubator shows, and he always encourages us to try something we've never done before, mm-hmm. or that's felt risky. And so in a previous incubator, I had blown fire. And so I was like, oh, what else feels risky to me? How about wrestling? And so I was thinking, what could be a good character to wrestle with? And I just pulled out Nate out of my back pocket and came up with the wrestling scene that you see in the full long hour show. But that was the first 10-minute piece that I created from the show.
Mm-hmm. Was Andy Kaufman an influence in that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I love Andy Kaufman. And yeah, he's definitely always lingering in my subconscious mind, for sure.
So what was it about wrestling that seemed risky, like in particular wrestling?
Well, just I think it's a funny idea to wrestle shirtless with another man, you know. Mm-hmm. It's kind of taboo. Also, you're putting your body at risk by challenging someone to a physical fight, and I'm challenging men who are, you know, most of the time have a physical advantage over me in terms of strength and weight and mass. Mm-hmm. So that's risky. And yeah, I think challenging anyone to a fight is risky. I don't know what you get up to on weekdays.
No, I guess I ask partly because I literally, if you Google like any review of Nate or you, everyone will describe you as fearless. It is it's like the most common adjective, I think, describing you. So I'm trying to get a sense of when you, a person who's described as fearless, and you can tell me if you actually are not a fearless person, are asked to do something risky. It's an interesting disconnect, because you're like, well, you understand what risks are, but is it a thing that you necessarily are? Do you feel fear when you do these things? I guess my question is, do you feel the emotion you imagine other people would feel doing these things? Like, are you afraid? Is that necessary? Like, or if you are afraid, how do you then approach things that you're afraid of?
Sure. You know, I do have a very high tolerance for fear, I suppose. So whenever, like Dr. Brown asks us to try something risky or that we feel is risky, I have do have a hard time thinking of what that could be because I'm like, well, nothing really scares me. I mean, maybe I would never want to do bodily harm to myself, mm-hmm. but I don't think like actually hurting yourself is risky or like seeking out actually hurting yourself. I don't think that's risky in the ways of comedy, you know, that's mm-hmm. something different. So yeah, it's challenging for me to feel fear on stage. I'd say what I'm most after is like an adrenaline rush, I guess. I don't really feel scared. I mean, I definitely get nervous before I do a show and especially before I try a new bit. But I'm not scared. I'm more excited to try something that I think is crazy.
Yeah.
And like to shock people, I think is so much fun.
So what was it about the first time you did the wrestling that from that point, what did you feel like worked about it? And what made you think, oh, maybe there's sort of more here? Sort of what is the process sort of from that to the now we're going to start in earnest trying to maybe make something out of this?
From the wrestling bit? Well, the 10-minute bit was so successful and I had already been thinking about what I was going to make for my next solo show because I had just gotten back from my first Edinburgh where I did a pretty good job and was trying to...
You won best newcomer, correct?
Yes, I won best newcomer. So I was trying to ride that wave, you know,
yes.
And everybody was encouraging me to make a second show. So I had that in the back of my mind. And then when that bit went so well, I was like, okay, I can definitely make 60 minutes off of this guy, this character. And the way I kind of work is just by scheduling one-hour slots at the Lyric Hyperion Theater and just booking myself on shows around town at the Virgil and Satellite, et cetera. And if I book like a one-hour show at the Lyric, I'll just invite people for free to come watch me try a bunch of stuff, and a lot of stuff is really, really bad. And then whatever seeds of what I improvise are good, I keep and I try again the next workshop. And that's kind of how I keep building my shows, is just keeping what works and bringing them back and refining them and trying them again and again and again.
When you're trying in the trying phase, how thoroughly are you beating out what you're going to do? Is it just sort of like you have ideas? Is it a amount where you're like, okay, I will like try to think of like 40 minutes worth of material and then 20 minutes I'm going to have to find it? How much of it is hoping that you're essentially just jumping and hoping on the other side there is, you know, someone there to catch you?
Initially, a lot of it is not very well thought out at all. At most, I'll maybe have, you know, 5 to 10 beats for a bit that I want to try. And most of the time, I'm just starting with an image that I have in my head. So there's a part in the show where I bring out a log and an axe and start chopping wood. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, it's just there for a moment, but it just came from me wanting to use that image. I just, you know, I jot down on a list different images and just try them out on stage. And I start with the image and then I see what comes from that, you know, just through improvisation and playing with the audience too. So much of how I work is through play with the audience and through improv. And but sometimes, I mean, you know, I do think of stuff, you know, I don't want to discredit myself there. I think of jokes. So like, for example, during the wrestling bit, like one of the gags that I initially thought of was, oh, I'll ask the audience member, I'll ask the girlfriend what kind of candy she prefers. And I'll ask her if she likes licorice or chocolate. And then if she says chocolate, I'll ask her milk or dark. And then if she says licorice, I'll ask her Twizzlers or Red Vine. Mm-hmm. And if she says Red Vine, I'll say black or red. And if she says Twizzlers, I'll say Pulls or Classics. And I had all those candy options on me at the time when I was workshopping that bit. And then you know, it turned into this gag where I just have tattoos.
Yeah.
Not to give it away, but yeah, I just gave it away. But
it's okay.
Yeah, so sometimes I have the joke planned out like that, and then how it kind of is refined is through simplification and, you know, finding a more economic way to do it. Mm-hmm. And then other times it's expanding it. So sometimes it's slimming it down, and sometimes it's expanding. So the axe, chopping the wood with the axe, that turned into just a transition piece. Mm-hmm. And then there were images that I started from, like, I don't know why I tried this, but it was Nate in a wedding dress putting on this unicorn head. I just had that image.
Sure.
And I danced around with that, and I tried that for like maybe a couple of minutes, and then I just took the mask off and I was like, okay, that's that. That didn't work. That was that.
Do you say out loud to the audience that didn't work, or is that internal?
Yeah, no, sometimes I'll say it. It depends how far along in the workshopping process I am. So if I'm in a place where I'm just trying out different pieces, you know, oftentimes I'll just drop character and be like, oh, that sucked or whatever. Yeah. Or even in character, be like, bah, that was bad or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, the next one I was going to say was Nate was saving people from a burning building.
Mm-hmm.
So I filled up the room with a fog machine and put on this like really huge flame retardant suit and was like carrying audience members the best I could over my shoulders.
Sure.
Onto the stage and like rescuing them by pulling them on the stage. Anyways, it was terrible. Really, really bad stuff. But
when things aren't working, I want to talk a little bit more of that, because in some ways it's like when a person starts stand up like for the first time ever, and they try things, and over time the audience sort of tells the performer what version of them makes sense. You know, like they'd be like, oh, your persona got to be this because this is what we like most about you, and then the comedian will become that way.
Yeah,
I was wondering what it's like with Nate. Like, do you feel like you know who Nate is, and then you just got to figure out ways to communicate that? Or are you essentially sort of creating character with the audience while you're trying these things out?
You know, that's interesting. You mentioned that, like, the comedian listens to what the audience likes, because that's a big part of clown and what they teach in beginner clown classes. There's this exercise where you have a friend on stage and a friend backstage, and the person who's backstage isn't allowed to look while their other friend chooses a very specific pose.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to come out on stage and try to figure out what that pose was. And when they're getting closer to the position, the audience claps. And when they're getting like very close to success, the audience claps louder. And so it teaches, and then when you get far away from it, the clapping goes away. So it teaches you to listen to what the audience likes and to follow the laugh and to follow, yeah, just what people are liking. And so, yeah, a lot of the times they teach that you should drop your planned bit and follow whatever people are laughing at and play that out fully in a game. And then you can always return to what you had planned, but never always be in the moment. And in terms of like creating Nate, I think like, yeah, I definitely probably, you know, adjusted the character based on what people were responding to, you know. Mm-hmm. But I did have him pretty well figured out going into it, but I'm sure that I adjusted for what the audience was approving of. And then if they disapproved of something, you know, you either drop it or you lean into it if they're, you know.
Do you, when you say you sort of knew who he was, is it a thing where, the example I use when I ask people characters, like, do you just sort of like instinctually know like what Nate's favorite movie is?
I guess, yeah. I mean, when you're in character, when you drop into a character, you kind of drop into their mindset. So I don't think Natalie, like right now when you ask me what Nate's favorite movie is, I have no freaking clue. But if I was in character, I would probably respond with something that was in line with Nate's personality, and everybody would be like, yeah, that makes sense that's his favorite movie. Yeah, it's more about like dropping in and then just being in that mindset, and then whatever you say is sincere, is honest. Yeah.
So around this time also Me Too is happening, and all these stories are coming out, and obviously this show is involved in a lot of those conversations, but a little bit tangential to explicitly the sort of Me Too movement. Were there times where there were more parts that were more explicit about it?
Yes. Definitely during the workshopping process. And initially, when I started workshopping the show, I had no intent of exploring consent or the gray area of consent, but all of this stuff about Me Too kind of erupted. And I initially was just thinking, oh, I'll make a show about masculinity and toxic masculinity. And I was like, how can I make a show about that and not address this that is so kind of intertwined with it? Like, you can't really explore toxic masculinity without exploring consent. But yeah, I was really scared to initially explore it because it is such a sensitive subject. And I just, you know, posted up trigger warnings outside the theater door saying this show's going to explore consent and toxic masculinity and may be triggering for some people. And I just, you know, on those signs would encourage people to just feel free to leave. Mm-hmm. You know, I would just say, you know, leave at any time. You know, and because I feel like a lot of people feel stuck in the seats because they don't want to feel rude, or like they don't want to hurt the artist's feelings, maybe.
Yeah.
Or at least that's always why I feel stuck in my seat if I think a comedy show sucks or something. But sometimes you just got to bust out of there. But there were bits that I was exploring. Like I had a box of Tic Tacs. And I would invite people on stage to have a drink with me, and I would like pop a couple Tic Tacs in their drink. And, you know, it was very obviously Tic Tacs. I still kept it in the Tic Tac box, but that just did not sit well with the audience at all. And I was just like, okay, yeah, we do not like that. Got it. Noted. You know, I thought it was absurd enough, but, you know, some stuff, it's interesting, like, where you can get laughs and where you can't, because I feel like definitely in Nate, the show as it exists right now, still has moments where you would think, like, oh, how is a laugh happening? I'm like, oh, wow, okay, people are laughing. That's good. Like, you know, it's dark comedy for sure. But, and then there's, you know, silences and tense moments where they're supposed to be, so that's good too. You know, the audience is in tune, but I just think it's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, when people decide it's okay to laugh and when they don't. There was also another scene I tried out. I think it was directly inspired by Harvey, but I invited an audience member up on stage to audition. You know, it was very on the nose. An audition. I had a script for them, and then I just started jacking off.
Sure.
While they were sitting there and just played around with that.
So consent obviously ended up becoming a lot of the focus. How did you, what were you seeing, or sort of what were you experiencing that sort of helped you land on your focus on the idea of consent and your angle on it? How did you sort of land on that specific perspective that sort of helped you orient the entire show?
Well, I think once I had acknowledged within myself that I was going to approach this subject, it, you know, was in the back of my mind. And so it just came out during improvisations, like the chugging contest that happens at the top of the show. Mm-hmm. I knew I wanted to do a chugging contest with the audience. So that was one of those images that I started with. I was like, okay, chugging beer or chugging cans. And that, through improvisation, turned into this chugging contest. And I had just improvised whoever wins gets to do whatever they want to whoever they want. So that was just improvised, I think, and it, you know, thematically revolved around consent because I had that in the back of my mind that I wanted to explore that. And then, you know, the approaching of the audience members after I had won the chugging contest, that was initially improvised as well. So my director would always say to me, you clock it and you keep it. So write it down. And then, you know, the way that I work and the way that I was taught to work by, you know, many of my clown teachers, and especially my director, is to do it the exact same way that you initially did it and that you initially improvised it. Because sometimes, you know, changing one little beat or one little word or one small movement throws off the whole gag.
I was talking to one of Helen, who I believe who interviewed you for the magazine, and
I love Helen.
And the thing we're talking about the process, and she was really interested about the editing of the show like this, because it's, you know, it's, I imagine there's parts that grow and shrink and throughout all of it, and we were both really curious about how do you edit down the show while still capturing the sort of energy of how you are as a performer, where there is so much that is uncertain. You know, as she put it, it's like you're the spaghetti that you're throwing against the wall. Like, you, there is this thing of you are exploring and trying things out, but you have to condense the show. What is editing for you? How do you sort of make sure every beat you have is part of the show and everything that you kick out is not in it?
It's really tough, and sometimes you take it out and then you have to put it back in or you rearrange it. A big part of my process is putting bits down on note cards or pieces or just gags on note cards, and I structure the entire show on my wall with these note cards and put them in the order of the show. But, you know, when I was figuring out the structure of the show, I took all the pieces that were successful from the workshops that at that point were just pieces and found a storyline within those. And just based on all the pieces that I had, I was like, oh, this is a love story. But yeah, before I went to Edinburgh, the show was still 15 minutes long. You know, it's got to be an hour, you know, based on the slot that you booked. You could book an hour and 15 minutes in Edinburgh, but I had an hour slot that year. And honestly, it was better off for it. We didn't need all that exposition in there. And, you know, maybe it's a little too exposition-y even right now. But, you know, some stuff I just don't know how to get around without explaining. But the show is so much fun, like putting it up live every time. And, you know, there is so much play, and I give the audience so much room to kind of fuck with me that it's fun. It's fun for me every time I do it. It never feels laborious or anything to keep trying out the show over and over and over again with these different structures. Keeps it exciting for me to also like have to remember it. And, you know, it's a good challenge.
I feel like from the sense I get is that you work very, very hard for a show like this, where ultimately you could beat it out, but it's a show that your process demands being in front of people, and you can only be in front of people, you know, an hour a day, so many days a week. What is the part of the process that is not like, are you sort of just constantly like thinking about this show at all hours until it's sort of done? Like, what is the sort of non-active process?
Yeah, it is all consuming to the point where, you know, I can barely make anything else when I'm working on an Edinburgh show. Like, it kind of takes up my whole life and I'm always thinking about it. And even when I'm at, like, thrift stores, and I'm just always thinking about gags and bits, or if I see something at a thrift store that's cool, I'm like, oh, wonder if I could put that into the show, or like, yeah, I'm just, but yeah, I think a lot of my friends would probably describe me as a hard worker. I'm pretty OCD, and I will harp on a bit and put it up again and again and again and again and again and again and again until I can get it exactly right. And, you know, sometimes I still can't even get it right, and it just really kills me. But, yeah.
I feel really, that is like, that, the way you phrase it, I just, that was very sweet. I was like, oh, no.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's sincere. Like, it does, it chew me up inside when I can't get something just right, or I can't nail a bit, or like, you know, the show is so alive that sometimes, you know, jokes don't land exactly how they should, even in comedy in general, you know, especially live shows, like, they don't always land as good as they did the night before, or the show before, or, you know, they don't land as well as the show will tomorrow, or the audience is different, or whoever you pick to interact with, they give you a hard time, or they're shy, or, you know, and sometimes you got to throw people back too. And, but then in Edinburgh, like, you have a kind of a split second time frame to decide if you're going to play with this person or not, because you don't have too much time.
Mm-hmm.
There's a show on right after you. Not much flexibility.
So to get back to the scene that we played at the top, how did this scene come about, and how does it fit into the show?
So the scene where I'm pouring the can on my face. How's it fit into the show? So this scene comes into the show right after Nate reveals to us that he was going to propose to his girlfriend, and she broke up with him. And he's really trying to express himself, which, you know, when he says express himself, we all, I think, can understand that he's trying to cry.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of a runner throughout the show. He says a few times, express yourself, Nate. Come on, Nate. Express yourself.
Yeah.
And we build from that moment where we initially see that he uses a can of water to feel what tears are.
Mm-hmm.
To the end of the show, where he's having a much more genuine moment of expressing himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other joke is the tuna casserole joke.
Oh, yes. That's also a runner throughout the show. Yeah. So, So he says, damn, I miss that tuna casserole, when he's talking about eating out his ex-girlfriend's pussy.
Mm-hmm.
It later informs, this is a spoiler, I guess, but an art piece that he has created. Yeah.
Was that something you thought of ahead of time? Was that something you riffed? Where does that come in from your brain to be a major part of the show?
Yeah. So sometimes, I mean, you know, sometimes it's a catch-22. Sometimes I'll think of one thing before the other. In this case, the payoff of the joke, which is the art piece, that didn't come till way after I started saying tuna casserole. I just started saying tuna casserole as a reference for his ex-girlfriend's pussy, just because I thought it was kind of nasty and fun and endearing that he liked to think of his girlfriend's pussy in this, like, you know, tasteless but thoughtful way.
Mm-hmm.
And then initially, when I was workshopping pieces, I had used just a random painting of a woman, and I had it hanging on his wall, and he was like looking up at it sad, as if it was a painting of his girlfriend. And then I thought, oh, wait, I'm a painter. I should paint what this girlfriend is like. And then I was like, oh, I should paint it using the tuna casserole joke. And that painted, that's actually a self-portrait.
I was wondering if you painted it, because I knew you were painter.
I painted that, and it's me.
It's interesting, because now you end up then playing the it then expands the amount of characters you're hypothetically playing in this.
Sure, sure, yeah, I guess so. But I left it faceless, you know, for the purpose of being the every woman.
Yes. What I like about both these jokes, and arguably sort of all the sort of joke lines in the show, opposed to sort of the more bigger comedic moments, is for how high-minded the concept is of this show and how hard you worked on it and how serious we are talking about it. These are like kind of stupid or lowbrow jokes. And I say that with a lot of affection.
Definitely. I love to ride that line of like lowbrow and, you know, springing back and forth between lowbrow and high-minded. And
I've heard you say that stupidity is a compliment in clowning. Or can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Yeah. So like a lot of the times people will overhear me saying to a friend like, oh my gosh, you're so stupid, or like, you're so dumb, and they look at me like I'm saying something mean, but to us it's a compliment, because at our best we're idiots. We're playing these beautiful idiots that are so stupid and so dumb, and so we think of dumbness and idiocy as these things of beauty. Mm-hmm. You know, they're beautiful to us, and it's a great success when you do something that's really, really fucking stupid. So we're always calling each other so dumb and so stupid and fucking idiots, but it's a term of endearment, because the clown is the idiot. You know, they're always figuring out ways to resolve problems in the most complicated, inefficient way. You know, like an example I always give is Lucy and Ethel eating the chocolates when they can't wrap them fast enough in the chocolate factory. You know, they're just like shoving the chocolates in their mouth, which is like the stupidest way to resolve that problem of the conveyor belt going too fast.
It's interesting you bring that up. I was thinking about that idea when I think about this scene, because part of it is to solve the problem of crying, which hypothetically is in some ways an easy thing. He thinks of the stupidest way of solving, which is pouring seltzer on his face.
Ah, yes, exactly.
So, in what ways is Nate a clown, or is doing the show clowning?
Well, I'd say the show is definitely a hybrid of many different things. I mean, clown in its purest form definitely has more innocence to it than this show has. I would say, you know, just Nate, this guy who's so deeply plagued by toxic masculinity, trying his best to do a show about consent, that has no clear message, is a very well-rounded clown game within itself, like a show that's supposed to teach something and teaches maybe nothing.
But still being optimistic.
Yeah, the clown is always the optimist. So in the end of the show, he says, I hope the message was clear. And, you know, earnestly believing that he has delivered something that has been clear, and it is not at all, which is, you know, the gag.
Yeah.
But yeah, the clown is always the optimist, and a story that a lot of my clown teachers have told is of the clown student who is always raising his hand to answer the teacher's question and getting it wrong every single time, but always still raising his hand to answer.
We'll be right back with more Natalie Palamides.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Life moves pretty fast. Are you drinking water that can keep up? Smartwater Alkaline has everything you need to stay hydrated, no matter where your day takes you. Whether you're pitching a tent or your next big idea, Smartwater Alkaline can help you perform your best. It delivers a pure, crisp taste that makes it the perfect chaser after a big workout. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
And we're back with Natalie Palamides. So in terms of sort of this as a clown and not a clown character, I have a bit of a sort of naughty question around this, and hopefully you can help me detangle it. So mm-hmm. I was thinking about the tension that exists here is clowning is sort of so rooted in vulnerability, where often characters are created in some ways to prevent or push away from personal vulnerabilities. You have the sort of thing in front of you. And I think another useful word is sort of exposing, right? Like an outsider will see the show and think maybe you're very physically exposed as Nate. But I've heard you talk about you don't even think of yourself as exposing yourself because this is Nate's body. So so where are you in this? What are you exposing? What are you not? What feels vulnerable? What isn't? I don't exactly know what the exact question is, but can you answer sort of all of this, all these thoughts I have around this subject?
You know, I'll do my best, Jesse. I mean, it's very layered, you know. It's a seven-layer dip.
Sure.
It's a rainbow cake of a show and a character. But, I mean, I would say, like, there's moments in the show, I think especially when I'm speaking with a couple, where you can see maybe Natalie pop out a couple times where, like, the woman that I'm speaking with in the audience, she really surprised me with how sassy she was.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can see a twinkle of Natalie's eye in there. But and definitely if you see the show live, I'm not sure how much it's in the Netflix special, but there are moments where I'll break and, like, you know, an audience member will make me laugh, you know, depending on what something – you know, ridiculous they say, or like a response that I've never heard to a question I ask before. Nate is very much this mask that I'm wearing. So not to say that you can't do clown when you're doing characters, it's just a fine line to walk, and you have to let yourself, or you have to let the clown peek through sometimes. And I think the moments when I'm doing Nate and I'm doing clown simultaneously, it's when I'm like winking at the audience. You know, so it's like I do something and then I look to the audience and kind of, you know, with a knowing look that, like, isn't this so fucking dumb and ridiculous?
Do you feel vulnerable at certain parts?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, like, there are moments that certainly, like, take me out of the character. Sometimes, you know, depending on the day when I'm doing the show, largely during the wrestling scene when I really have to be on alert and connect with the person across from me and kind of send some ESP messages to them and be like, okay, you know, I am, you know, a vulnerable little lady. Like, before I went to Edinburgh, I didn't have any kind of written directions or anything for the audience member that comes up to wrestle me. But when I went to Edinburgh, because they have so many risk assessments in the UK, they take theater very much more seriously than we do in Los Angeles. So they make you do risk assessments. And part of my risk assessment was that I would need to tell the audience member that I'm going to wrestle them, and I had to ask them if they had any injuries that I needed to be aware of. And so the way I do that now is by, there's a little piece of paper inside the waiver that I give the audience member to sign, and it says, "You're about to wrestle Nate for real. Please let him know if you have any injuries or sensitivities. And also remember that Nate is just a little lady, so please wrestle gently but with passion." Sometimes, and mostly, you know, before I had that little written note in there, I really had to, like, sometimes step out of the character fully and be like, you know, this is just a show, right? Or like, whoa, like, watch out, we're just playing. Yeah. And sometimes I would totally drop the voice. Sometimes I would stay in Nate's voice and be like, whoa, whoa, you know, it's just a show, man. Or like, relax, you know, because I am taunting these guys. And, you know, sometimes it can get pretty intense, like, depending on the person. And then sometimes it's so mild that I'm using my stage combat skills to just make it look like they're doing stuff to me. And I'm essentially like wrestling myself. So it's a wide range.
Yeah, it is interesting. Both the when I saw it live and this time, there is this moment where you see the man try harder as the time goes on.
And yeah.
And it's hard. And there's a vulnerability to that man who like unknowingly is revealing his desire to like be strong in that moment.
Yeah.
It's so human. Both times, I was really just like, wow, this guy is now trying weirdly hard.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that is definitely a big part of it most of the times that I'm wrestling. Like, it becomes, like, really real for him that he's fighting for his girlfriend's love or her honor.
Watching this special, one of the things I found fascinating is, so after you say the tuna casserole joke, you cut to a woman not laughing. What is so incredible about seeing the show live is the entire room is lit. And as an audience member, since for the most part, you've mostly performed it. I know sometimes Dr. Brown has performed it. But for the most part, as an audience member, I can tell you, you're sort of looking around and you're nervous. What's going to happen? You don't know. And how did you go about trying to achieve that in a film piece? How do you capture the sort of social aspect of that tension?
Yeah, well, I mean, honestly, in the editing room, we were kicking ourselves for not getting enough audience shots. Like, we only had one camera on the audience, and some of the times it wasn't even on the audience. So we really had to, like, dig around to find audience shots. And we cut to that girl not laughing because that was the only shot we had, but also we thought it was funny that she wasn't.
Yes.
Like, finding it too funny. So we thought it was funny that she didn't find it funny. Yeah.
So, and then were there other things that you did to try to make it capture that same feeling? Are you definitely nervous that you didn't capture it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely when we were editing, we were like, fuck, dude, like, oh my God, like, we should have got way more audience reactions. But I think, you know, I think we did a good job with what we had. And I think, like, what I like about the shots that we did get is, like, there's some shots from behind, you know, there's, like, some cameramen on stage that show me with the audience behind me. And I think that does a good job of capturing the energy and seeing everybody having fun or not having fun.
One of the other decisions you guys make is you start the special with people talking about seeing the show, including Amy Poehler. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that decision?
Yeah, so I think largely it is to get people to watch it and to be patient with somebody that they have no familiarity with. You know, I'm not famous. Nobody knows who I am. And so definitely, like, having Amy there to vouch for me hopefully will help people want to watch it, I guess.
Yeah.
And definitely that was, like, informed also, like, in addition to, like, trying to get the show down to 1 hour, we also, like, cut one of my favorite parts at the beginning of the show where I'm just smashing bottles and sunglasses. But it's just doesn't quite play the same without being there in the room and having the tension. So, you know, as you could see, we just started straight with, like, the passing out of the LaCroix, which really gutted me. And maybe if I was famous, people would be patient enough to watch it.
Yeah. like, as a person who went to see it, I had some idea of the tone of it, and it's almost like a trigger warning, but not with doing a trigger warning. It's basically being like, this is a show that you're going to have to sit through, and it's like about subjects. And it does, I imagine, for people who are going in completely cold, it's an easier, it's like going into a pool through the steps slowly, opposed to being like, here's Nate, you have no idea who this person is underneath.
Yeah, exactly. But it's kind of a cool intro, no? It gets you pumped, I think, with the style of editing. Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about your relationship to audiences and the audience. And first, by telling you the sort of audience member I am, which I imagine you are familiar with all types. So I was the sort that tried to sit as far in the back as possible and not make eye contact with you almost ever. Is that something you can read? Like, was it feel like when you have these moments that need audience participation and you are sort of this trapeze artist flying through the air and need to find the person who's going to catch you, are you like surveying the area like the Terminator and figuring out what type of people everyone is?
Yeah, so it's a bunch of different things. So sometimes I'll look for people who are smiling and enjoying the show, and then sometimes I will pick out the people like you who are avoiding eye contact just because I think it'll be a fun challenge to get them to play along. And also, by the same token, I'll pick out people who look like they're not enjoying the show at all, just for another challenge to like try to get them to have some fun and laugh. And sometimes, you know, that I do a disservice to myself by doing that, but... Yeah, and then, you know, sometimes I use the technique, like in the show when I call out, hey, Lucas, I'm essentially like, it's funny how many people think I'm looking right at them, and I'm just looking in a general direction into a void, into the pitch black, because that's actually a moment in the show where I'm in a spotlight, and, you know, a rare time the audience is in pitch black.
Oh, interesting.
And so I'm just looking out into the abyss, calling out, hey, Lucas. And I just wait for somebody essentially to volunteer themselves and say, hey, Nate, back to me. And sometimes it happens more quickly than other times.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like the time I saw it live, it seemed like the people you called on were like pretty game to do it, where the special you find that couple who seem not that interested in doing it, and then the woman seemed particularly not interested, but also like particularly played along to like whatever her character should be. And I was like, and I think this is partly why it worked surprisingly well. I was like, oh, is this going to work taped? And that guy, I was like, oh, I think he does not want to do this. And then slowly he sort of gets caught up in it.
Oh, yeah, the couple that I wrestle, or the guy that, if I remember correctly, his friends were pointing to him. They didn't volunteer, and they were way up in the back, I don't know why I was just like, went for them. I think sometimes it's fun to go with people sitting in the back row. They think they're not going to be part of it at all, and you just... Yeah, throw him a curveball with that.
It's good to know that if you do another show that I have to find a new place to hide.
Yeah, nobody's safe. Nobody's safe no matter where you sit.
I've heard you talk about how do you balance your desire to take care of the audience with your desire to make them uncomfortable?
Oh, I just try to stay sensitive about where the line is. And some people, you know, may think that I crossed the line, but I don't know. It's just something that you can kind of gauge and feel out after, you know, performing a ton. You know, you just start to develop this relationship with listening to the audience, you know, like we spoke about earlier. And you can feel when you've totally lost them because you've gone too far. And so I try to just really practice riding that line and just do my best to, you know, explore sensitive issues, you know, while just while also being sensitive.
Yeah.
But also, you know, to also like have fun. Like my goal is to make people think, but most importantly, to make people laugh. You know, that's why I try to, after that, you know, tense kind of moment at the end of the show, I try to have at least one more joke, you know, because I want to send people out laughing. That's my goal first and foremost.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the ending without necessarily spoiling too much of it, but the sort of perspective on the ending, which is, it's clear you do not want the show to be didactic. The show, if anything, is sort of against the idea that a show should tell you exactly what it's thinking.
Yeah.
But you clearly want the audience to feel something. What is that feeling you're hoping for? Is there a specific feeling? How do you create a show to create whatever feeling you do or do not want them to feel?
Well, yeah, I guess like, you know, you spoke before about making people feel uncomfortable. And I guess my goal in making people feel uncomfortable and myself as well is to push people past this point of discomfort. And it's like, okay, we pulled the Band-Aid off. We got past that point, and now we can have real conversations about this thing. We got past the bad part. And, you know, there's that part in the show where Nate asks everyone a question and it's met with this silence in the room, and then answers slowly trickle in and people see friends that they came with answering differently than they do. And I think the show, or, you know, the atmosphere I'm just trying to create is is just for people to, I just want them to talk to each other about it, because I think speaking face to face about sensitive issues in general, not just about consent, but about masculinity and anything else that, you know, we so often talk about on Twitter and these like very blunt forms of communication, need to be addressed while you're looking into somebody's eyes and you can breathe on them. You know, like we need to discuss these sensitive issues face to face. Otherwise, we're never going to cover any ground, and it's going to remain a hostile subject and a subject that people are afraid to approach with their friends because they're afraid of being viewed a certain way or hurting somebody. I don't think any real progress can be made on these kind of topics until we learn to talk about them face to face. And that's kind of the impetus for bringing the subject matter into the theater. It's like, what better place to bring people face to face than a room where they have to sit right next to each other.
Yeah.
And
I think it's to that point that a clown rooted character is an interesting way, because it really like normalizes or demystifies like a person failing at this or being uncomfortable at this.
Yeah, nobody knows.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what the right answers are. And I think a big point that I'm trying to make is each situation is so specific, you know, and we need to talk about them in order to truly like figure them out.
So as a show about consent, how did it make you think about the relationship of consent between audience and performer?
Yeah, that's definitely a big part of the show, isn't it?
Yeah,
because I am engaging the audience in so many different ways. And most of the time I am asking them. And some of the times I engage with them without asking them. Mm-hmm. And I think, that's part of the show. Of course, you know, I try to do it in a way that is, you know, sensitive. And I try to, my goal is never to harm anyone. But, you know, there's a part of the show where I flick the man's nipples that comes up on stage. And a lot of the time that moment is met with the man saying, "Hey, you didn't ask." And I'm just like, yeah, whatever. You know, like, because I'm so diligent at the top of the show asking people if I can touch them, that it's kind of a gag in that moment. And it also speaks to how we, you know, see men's bodies in a different way than women's bodies. And it's like, it's more casual. Like, everybody's laughing at, you know, me twerping this guy's nipples or whatever. But if I had done that to a woman, you know, at the top of the show, it would have been taken very differently. So, yeah, it's funny. And even, you know, I'm editing a trailer right now to put out for the show. And Netflix is like, yeah, do whatever you want with the trailer. But unfortunately, we can't put it up on our platforms unless your nipples are censored. And so...
Unbelievable.
So it's just funny as I'm editing, like, my nipples, there's this one moment in the trailer where, you know, I'm twapping this guy's nipples and I have to censor my nipples but not his. And we essentially look the same, you know, we're like roughly the same size and have about the same size boobs. You know, I'm not really that gifted in that area. But yeah, so it's just it's funny. Yeah. You know, but I know I can't really figure it out. It's just fun to present it and see how people react. And is it okay? Is it not okay? Is it sometimes okay? Does it depend on the intent? Does it depend on the energy of the person? Mm-hmm. Like, because sometimes, you know, and maybe this, you know, this isn't PC to say, but sometimes people give consent with their energy, right? And that's my job as the performer, to like feel out their energy. But it's like sometimes, like, you know, sex is something that you shouldn't leave up to energy. Yeah. You know, when I'm twapping a guy's nipples, you know, that's not the same as if I'm gonna have sex with him.
Yeah.
Like, so I feel more comfortable making a decision based on the energy I'm receiving from him because of what I'm about to do. If I was about to do something, you know, more invasive, or, you know, then, you know, it's just, it's nuanced, you know,
yeah.
Jesse?
Like,
and
okay.
So, yeah, it's each situation is very specific, but
did you find that when you mentioned it being specific, did you find that with each show, do you feel like different shows you play the situations differently, and as a result, the audience?
Yes, each situation is different. Sometimes the guy won't even take off his shirt, and and I say usually after he says he won't take off his shirt, I say okay. Nobody has to do anything they don't want to do. I think maybe I say that even in the special, or maybe it was cut, but there's a point where I ask him, or I offer up my nipples. After I twap his nipples, I kind of offer up mine, and he says, no, no. And I'm like, come on, you know, twap him. And then I say, okay, nobody has to do anything they don't want to do. And then I, you know, make them wrestle me. You know? But... But again, like, if he didn't want to wrestle me, you know, he doesn't have to. Like, I've had shows where people don't wrestle me, or somebody else comes up to wrestle for their girlfriend's honor, and, you know, they leave with their tail in between their legs or whatever. Or sometimes they just stand there and I ask them to hold my wrist and I'm wrestling myself. So, you know, when I say nobody has to do anything they don't want to do, I mean it. You know, for sure. But then there's also this pressure probably that they feel because they're in a live show and an audience is watching them, and, you know, they don't want to suck the fun out of it or whatever, and they feel pressure to play along. You know, and that kind of speaks to pressures that we feel all the time in these situations where we're being asked about consent. So I think it just, like, brings an absurd angle consent.
And also makes it a little bit safer than, and it's an interesting exercise in the conversation.
It's an exercise in the conversation. That's exactly it, Jesse. It's just like presenting people with all these different ways that consent can be had and not be had. And yeah, throughout the show, it happens many, many times. Yeah.
You mentioned feeling the energies of the people and having that be consent or not. In what way is your connection to the audience spiritual, and how is the performance like a ritual for you?
Oh gosh. Well, you know, I think that any performer will tell you that they can feel the audience's energy. I mean, that's why most people do it, because it feels so good when you have a good show, like the energy, the positive energy that you feel. And even after an audience member goes to a good show, they're all juiced up because of the positive energy that's in the room. So I think it just speaks to the power of positive energy and laughter and joy. Mm-hmm. And and it also speaks to the power of, like, you know, a room full of silence and the energy that's in that. And you can feel that when there's tension in the room and when there's confusion and there's caution and trepidation. Like, I'm not really sure if it's spiritual, but I guess so. I mean, yeah, I don't know, just you can feel when something feels good and you can feel when it feels bad. And it's a large part of the human experience. And that's what's missing from social media.
Yeah. You mentioned social media, and I think it's an interesting thing to think about in terms of audience. You know, this show exists in a certain comedy and theater context, and then you're sort of bringing it to the contextless world of the internet. And like you said, theater is a place where you can sort of put ideas in front of people and they just have to sit with it, where the internet is not that. How do you feel about this?
Well, I feel terrible about it, Jesse. It's like the internet is like one of the greatest weapons against mankind. It's gonna bring us down because, like I was saying earlier, we just can't make any progress on any kind of important issues until we get back to just having town halls. Yeah. You know, like, the internet cannot be our town hall. Our town hall has to be a place where everybody goes in the town to a hall with their bodies, with their faces, with their eyes, with their mouths, and are in a room with one another. I think social media does a great disservice to us. I mean, of course, you know, it's an important tool and it can be used for good things, but we have to put it in a box and we have to acknowledge that it's not a good way to communicate about important issues. And I think we need a lot of people to get on board with that idea. But it's just like nobody knows exactly how to tackle this beast.
Yeah.
And it's like we've unleashed the beast. How do we get it back into its arena? And let's use social media what it's good for and not let it, you know, suck all of our empathy out of us. You know, it allows for no empathy or nuance. And that's why, you know, that's why when you want to have an important conversation with a friend or loved one, you call them or you meet up with them. You know, you don't text them because, you know, everybody always says, you know, texting arguments always end badly because you can't tell. Even emails, people get scared to write emails because they're afraid they're going to be taken the wrong way. You know what I mean? It's just like texting is a terrible form of communication. Even letters are better. At least you get some sense of, like, oh, care when you get a letter. Like, texts are just so flippant and brief and easy to send. There's no care behind them. And that's, we need to take better care of each other. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I guess yes, you did. I think you answered part of my question, which is, one, how do you feel? The second question, part of it, is sort of like, it's ever since I've seen this show, I was like, what's going to happen with this show? Like, I saw both shows and I love both of them. I was like, well, Nate's the one they'll film because it's easier to explain and it has clear social themes, blah, blah, blah. But I was like, what's going to happen when they film it? Like, how will people react to this thing? And I'm sure you've existed in a world where someone has thrown the word Nanette around because it's a thing that's on Netflix and it's like not traditional stand-up and it's about these themes.
Mm-hmm.
what do you, good or bad, or you at your most lofty of how great it can go? You, like, what do you imagine happening? Because this interview is going to come out the day it comes out, and who knows how the world will react to this thing.
I know, Jesse. I freaking don't know. I'm nervous as hell. And yeah, people have said to me, like, oh, this is going to be a talking piece like Nanette was. And, you know, my insecurity just says to me, nobody's even going to watch it. Mm-hmm. Nobody's even going to watch it. But then the other side of me is like, but if people do watch it, maybe they won't like it, you know, or they're not going to think it's funny and I shouldn't have cut that joke and I did it all wrong, you know. But right now, I'm feeling like I'm just like scared nobody's going to watch it.
People will watch it.
I know. At least for like my tits are out the whole time.
Yeah, that will be a headline for lesser places. They'll be like, well, there's a place to see someone's boobs and be like, all right.
Yeah. Lowbrow headline for my, very fitting for my sense of humor.
I think there'll be, that's the thing that I'm, as a person who's on the sort of journalism side of it, I'm like, I imagine there'll be incredibly highbrow headlines about it and some really lowbrow headlines about it. And I have no sense of like what the discourse will be.
Sure.
But also,
that's interesting.
But also it's like, I guess the question is, why do it? You know, can you put a finger on, you want to create this sort of like challenging work, this thing that is really true to sort of who you are as an artist, but you were putting it in a position where possibly as many people could see it as can see a thing. What is that?
Gosh, I mean, that is like dumb luck, Jesse. I don't know, for like an artist to have be on a platform with the possibility of so many eyes. You know, I feel really lucky and like blessed to have the opportunity, but I'm also excited at the possibility that it will create more reasonable discourse around sensitive issues. And I hope, what I hope for most is that it makes people realize that we need to have conversations in rooms with each other more, even though we might, you know, we have to wear masks now. Mm-hmm. You can still use your mouth behind a mask. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to answer because I imagine it is. I could only imagine how overwhelming it is for you. I mean, like, I think about anytime I put out something, like, okay, when I have a decent sense of how many people will reach it, but like, there's so few things that go from such a small world to hypothetical. So.
Yeah, I mean, I'm usually playing for like 30 to 100 people.
Yeah.
This is definitely going to be different. I hope that people receive it in the way that I intend for it to be received. But, you know, I can't feel the room.
Yeah.
I can't adjust. So it's like if somebody is taking it a certain way in their living room, I can't feel that person. I can't feel their energy shift. I can't take a moment to talk with them and see what's going on, you know? And that's something that I think every comedian does when they see somebody's having a sour time or whatever. You engage with them. Like, I won't be able to engage with people when they're in their living room watching this. And so it's a bit nerve-wracking that, you know, the energy that comes from this show is kind of out of my hands, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, and then I've been a cyber bullied before whenever I was cast as the Powerpuff Girl. A lot of, like, grown adults were mad that I wasn't the original voice actor. But so I'm like, oh, I wonder, like, if I'll get any rage from the internet about this. But you know what? If people don't like it, at least I hope they're talking about it. And I hope they're talking about it with their friend in person and not just on Twitter.
So So that sound means it's time for our final segment. It's the laughing round. It's like a lightning round, but because this is a comedy show, it's the laughing round.
All right.
Do you have a favorite joke? Like a joke joke?
Favorite joke joke. Oh, I know this part's supposed to be fast.
It's okay. It never is. It doesn't even have to be good. It just has to be the one you think of.
Okay, this is one I think of. A joke that I recently saw was in the Three Stooges, a cuckoo clock keeps coming out of the house, or, you know, a bird from the cuckoo clock keeps flying out, and he is repairing, or he's painting the bird on the cuckoo clock, but he doesn't turn off the cuckoo clock and take the bird out. He waits until the bird comes out of the door and goes, cuckoo. And he paints it just very little every time it comes out.
Got it.
Which is a very long-winded explanation of a very simple gag, visual gag. Mm-hmm. I hope it reads. It's just so dumb.
It is funny. You say it, I'm like, it's a type of joke, visual joke, that I feel like I've seen 9,000 times and I might have seen it never. Like, it's so... Like, you can see cartoons doing it, like, you can imagine.
Yes. Yes, it's classic. It's classic.
Is there a joke or a character that you'd like to steal? Like, a character that anyone has ever done ever that you wish could be your character and you'd get to do it?
Probably Austin Powers. I love Austin Powers so much. I love Mike Myers and... I just love all the dumb gags that they do in those movies with, like, the tits, the melon tits, and, yeah, just the whole world, Fat Bastard, Austin Powers. He's, like, just this horny, lovable guy. Yeah.
Do you have a comedy crush, a person whose comedy you have a crush on? And if so, who?
Maybe Amy Sedaris doing Jerry from Strangers with Candy, Jerry Blank. I've always had a comedy crush on Jerry Blank.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
What is the first voice you can remember doing, and what is the last voice you've come up with?
The first voice, honestly, Austin Powers when I was a kid. I would be like, yeah, baby. I'm horny, baby. Yeah.
Were you saying that?
Maybe like 9 or 10.
Cool.
And my dad was like, Nat, don't say that. Anyway. and then the most recent character I came up with is this Italian guy. I do a duo with my friend Courtney Peroso, and we play these two Italian guys, Rigatoni and Ziti Paloroso. Mm-hmm. And we're these two Italian guys that are stoked that Jill Biden's the first Italian-American. In the White House.
Can you tell me what her voice sounds like?
Rigatoni. Oh, his voice. Yeah, his voice. He's like, hey, how's it going? How you doing?
Cool.
Jill Biden, the first Italian American in the White House.
And last one. I assume there's many, but can you think of a character that you came up with that you are like, this is brilliant, this is great, and then you try in front of one audience or multiple audiences, and the audience was like, I do not get this. But you'll go to your grave being like, that was funny, they were wrong.
Huh. Well, that's tough to say because I, like, always try to make something work. And I don't know, this character, I dropped this character after doing it one time because I was like, ugh. This sucks or whatever, but people are like, that had legs. It was a hiker that gets her arm stuck in a rock, you know, like 127 hours. And I cut off my own arm and I have a package of barbecue rib meat in my sleeve. So I'm just like pulling out a ton of meat. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, the bit. It's not, I don't know if it's dead, so I don't know if that answers your question completely.
We'll see.
I'm like,
that's the one that is closest to it, though.
I've done it, and I was like, ugh, that's bad.
Is it that people thought it was too gross?
No, I think that I more thought like it was just like a one trick wonder. Like after I cut off the arm, what do I do? So I cut off the arm, and then after I cut off my arm, I said that I hit my head, and under my hat I had more rib meat that was like brains. And as I pulled the brains out, I started going A B C D da da da, and then you know acted like I forgot the ABCs.
Got it.
And you know it sounds funny now that I'm saying it back. I'm like maybe I should give that one another go.
Yeah, it does. But, I do think it has legs.
Yeah, but it just didn't really hit that well. Yeah.
All right, that is it. Thank you so much. That was so great.
That was really great. Thank you so much for having me, Jesse. I really appreciate it.
That's it for another episode of Good One. You can watch Nate on Netflix. Follow Natalie on Twitter at NatDogCatDog, and that's cat with a K, and on Instagram at Natalie Palamides. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, Hannah Rosen, and Camila Salazar. God from Shugashin did our theme song. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts, 5 stars. Please email any comments, questions, or laughing around suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us at goodonepodcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me at Jesse David Fox. Good One is a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. We'll be back next week with David Sedaris. Have a good one.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.